So tonight's talk, I gave the title Thoughts on Death and Dying. And this is a topic that came up for me quite strongly over the last 3 weeks or so. About 3 weeks ago, an old friend of mine, someone I'd known for almost 40 years, she lived with my wife and I and our family for 17 years in Ottawa before we moved here, passed away from cancer. She was same age as me. And it sort of shook me a little bit, but she had been on having some health problems and had led quite a tough life, actually. On Monday morning, another friend of mine died of COVID. Same situation. I'd known him for over 40 years. Had lived with us at times. His family and our family grew up together. Another old close friend. So, of course, these deaths weighed on my mind and also made me stop and think about death and dying. But I wanted to think about them and talk about them from the Buddhist perspective. What did the Buddha say about this? And what do Buddhist teachers say about these topics and how to work with them skillfully, both in our practice and in our lives? And so that's the theme of the whole talk. And I've got a large number of references and things I want to read. And really, this is, it's just thoughts. These are like, here's all these different thoughts I've had over the last little while, over the last few days. And as I, even as I was putting the talk together, I was remembering things I'd read before and trying to fit this all together. Anyhow, I want to start by reading something from this book, The Zen of Therapy by Mark Epstein. Mark, if you're not familiar with him, this is actually Dr. Mark Epstein, right? He's a psychotherapist, but also a very long-term practitioner. He was one of Joseph Goldstein's original students and has been practicing for over 40 years in this tradition. At the same time, he's been practicing and working as a psychotherapist in a traditional Freudian way to a certain extent, but somehow blending those two things together quite skillfully. Anyhow, I wanted to read this particular story. This book is full of stories of things he encountered along the way and how he could relate to them. And it's on the theme of the night, shall we say. A good friend of mine from high school had just died after a 3-year battle with cancer. We were visiting his wife several days later to bring her some food. Her son and daughter-in-law and their 2-year-old son are also there. We bring them bread from the bakery near us, chopped liver, an eggplant dip my wife had prepared, and a polenta and spinach casserole. After sitting and talking and eating, I get up to wash the dishes. The son and daughter-in-law are in the kitchen with me, and to my surprise, ask if they can ask a professional question. What should we say to our son, they want to know. It has not occurred to me that their son would not yet know about his grandfather's death. I feel for their predicament. How are they to introduce death to this open, trusting, loving child? He keeps asking, where's Grandpa? They say, we told him he's away for a while. You didn't tell him anything yet? I inquire, stalling a bit, not yet knowing how to best say what I am thinking. How come? I didn't see the point in ruining his perfect life, the father responds. It's up to you how you want to deal with it, I begin, knowing in my heart that the boy's perfect life has already been disrupted. And I think you should tell him the truth. How you phrase it depends on what you think, but I might say something like, Grandpa died. His body couldn't go on any longer, so he had to let it go and get ready for the next one. I actually believe that. I continue gathering steam. So it would be a natural for me to phrase it that way, but what you say is less important than acknowledging the fact. He's going to sense that something has happened. He will hear conversations about it, and there's a funeral coming, and if you don't explain it, he will make something up about it that will be all the more confusing because you don't know what he is thinking. The worst thing would be that he feels your tension around it and your sadness at the loss and thinks that it is because of something he did. Kids feel what's going on around them, but they can't understand, and they make it up, make it be about them if you don't explain it. Death is very hard for any of us to understand. It will certainly be difficult for him, but he will grow into it, and you can help him over the years. I tell how our son, at an early age, got very anxious when we did not explain to him what was going on with his grandmother, who was diagnosed with cancer. It finally emerged that he had heard the word cancer and not known what it meant. He understood that it was bad, but he wrongly assumed that his mother, not his grandmother, had it. His anxiety settled down after we did our best to explain what was going on. So this is talking very directly about children, but I wanted to bring this topic up because I think it's important, not just how we talk to children about this, but how we talk about death in general. We often try, we don't want to talk about it. We have these sort of interesting euphemisms for death that people we use. One of my teachers was from Australia. And she used to get phone calls from her mother in Australia every once in a while about someone that she knew because it was her mother's friend or something like that. And her mother would say to her, you know, Mrs. So-and-so, she fell off her perch. Like she was a canary or something. And because she couldn't come out and actually say those words. It's very common in our culture not to want to talk about death. And it's something we have to learn somehow that it's okay. As Mark said, we have to be careful about our words and, you know, say something that's age appropriate if we're talking to someone younger. But it's not like we can't pretend that it doesn't happen. Because it does all the time. I mean, all around us, all the time, it's happening. And I think for me, of course, you know, I'm getting into that older age where now my chief experience with my friends is that some of them are dying. Old friends are gone. Several of them over the last couple of years. These two came quite quickly. Didn't know either of these situations were happening until it happened. And it's just like, oh yeah, I have to be okay with this, but I also have to like be free to talk about it. And I think in general, we all have to be free to talk about the fact that this is part of life. I've got several quote several things from the sutta here. This is and the Buddha talking about, in what is aging and death? What is the origin of aging and death? What is the cessation of aging and death? What is the way leading to the cessation of aging and death? The aging of beings in the various orders of beings, their old age, brokenness of teeth, grain of hair, wrinkling of skin, decline of life, weakness of faculties, that is called aging. The passing of beings out of the various orders of beings, their passing away, dissolution, disappearance, dying, completion of time, dissolution of the aggregates, very Buddhist way of saying it, laying down of the body. This is called death. So this is aging and this is death. This is what are called aging and death. With the arising of birth, there is the arising of aging and death. The cause of aging and death is birth. It's a very interesting way to think about it, right? It's like, oh, yep, I got born, therefore this is what's coming. No matter, you know, with the cessation of birth, there is the cessation of aging and death. The way leading to the cessation of aging and death is just this Noble Eightfold Path. So he's saying, because this is another part of the traditional belief, is that at a certain point, when someone actually becomes an enlightened being, that's it. As far as having physical bodies, the physical body they have now, when they become enlightened, this is their last physical body. It's like the energy of that collection of karmic results that came into being in this particular physical form is now done. Because its purpose, the purpose of that collection of karmic energy was to have someone bring an enlightened being into the world. Because when an enlightened being comes into the world, it changes the whole world. Sometimes in small ways, sometimes in huge ways. I mean, look at the Buddha and Jesus, for instance. Or Mother Teresa being a more current example as far as I'm concerned. It's like these people change. You know, the Buddha lived 2,500 years ago, and here we are talking about him and what he taught. It's a very powerful thing, but it's sort of like the end of this cycle. So that's one interesting thought. The cause of aging and death is birth. Guaranteed. You know, so there's this sort of, you can see this as being a meme on Facebook or something, or it says something of that sort of thing. You know, life is a disease with 100% mortality rate. That's the truth of things are. Then the Buddha goes on in another sutta, and this is one of those suttas where someone has come to him and is asking questions about things, how things are, how things should be, and what are the answers to some of these, what we'll call the great questions. And the Buddha in this particular sutta is basically listing things for which he will not give an answer, which frustrates the person who came to talk to him, because this person came to talk to him and had these sort of what are considered deep philosophical questions. And this is the Buddha going through his list. He says, remember what I have left undeclared as undeclared, and remember what I have declared as declared. And what have I left undeclared? The world is eternal. I have left undeclared. The word is not eternal. I have left undeclared. The world is finite. I have left undeclared. The world is infinite. I have left undeclared. The soul is the same as the body. I have left undeclared. The soul is one thing and the body another. I have left undeclared. After death, a Tathagata, an enlightened being, exists. I have left undeclared. After death, a Tathagata does not exist. I have left undeclared. After death, a Tathagata both exists and does not exist. I have left undeclared. After that, a Tathagata neither exists nor does not exist. I've left undeclared. So he's saying these are all questions that he's never given an answer to. And then these are like, a lot of these questions are about death, right? What happens after death and those sorts of things. You know, how did this all start? How's it all going to end? Why have we left that undeclared? Because it is unbeneficial. It does not belong to the fundamentals of the holy life. It does not lead to disenchantment, to dispassion, to cessation, to peace, to direct knowledge, to enlightenment, to nirvana. That is why I've left them undeclared. In other suttas, he calls these things useless speculations. And this is the problem. This is something that people do all the time. They want answers to these huge questions, particularly about what happens after death. And the Buddha is basically saying, don't waste your time trying to figure these things out. Instead, just follow the Noble Eightfold Path. Do your practice. You don't need to understand and know these things. It isn't at all essential for you to do the practice to know any of these answers. But it's something that pretty much every Western philosophical system I know of has struggled around these issues. How do I answer these questions? You know, and they all come up with their own version of an answer, right? None of which make any sense, actually, when you start to really look at them. And in several traditional Southeast Asian teachings that the Buddha was familiar with, this was also a common thing to do, to try and answer these questions. And he's saying, don't even think about this stuff. Don't even bother to think about it. Just do the practice. And that's fine. You know, we don't have to figure out about what our past lives were, or what's going to happen when we die. All these things are just going to agitate us, because we're not going to ever find a good answer. We're not going to find an answer that rings true. We may find an answer that we're sort of okay with, because that's traditionally what's been said, but that's just tradition. It doesn't really mean anything. This is hard, because what about my two friends? What happened to them? Where are they now? They both led good lives. They were both very long-term practitioners. One in yogic tradition, and the woman had been a nun in a Zen monastery for 10 years, among other things. Very, very serious practitioners. I'm sure they made the transition to wherever it happened they went to just fine. But what happened to them? I don't know. For me to even speculate, it would just be a waste of time. They've moved on, whatever happened. It's hard because we want answers to these questions, especially with people we love. What happened to them? But we can never find a satisfactory answer, one that is truly meaningful. And trying to figure that out is a distraction from the practice. And that's the key point that the Buddha is trying to make here. It's just we're letting ourselves be distracted from the practice. Then in the next sutta, this is one of the suttas where a householder comes. Sometimes it's a Brahmin, sometimes it's another monk, but always these people are coming to ask the Buddha questions. So many of the suttas in the Majjhima Nikaya are of this nature. In this case, it's a householder. Then that householder went to the Blessed One, and after paying homage to him, sat down at one side. The Blessed One said to him, "Householder, your faculties are not those of one in control of his own mind. Your faculties are deranged. In other words, you're acting kind of crazy. Right? How could my faculties not be deranged, venerable sir? For my dear and beloved only son has died. Since he died, I have no more desire to work or to eat. I keep going to the charnel ground and crying, my only son, where are you? My only son, where are you? The Buddha answers, so it is, householder. So it is. Sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair are born from those who are dear. Arise from those who are dear. So the deepest, he's saying this is quite a profound thing. He's saying the things that cause us the most grief and despair are the things we love the most when they go, as all things do. Whether it's a person, whether it's an ability, you know, like we, you know, as you get older, you start being not able to do things you used to love to do. I was talking to a 94-year-old man today in the hospital where I work as a chaplain part-time. And he was saying, you know, 3 years ago, so he's 91, 3 years ago, I was still teaching skiing. And now I can't teach skiing anymore. But it really bothered him. You know, he was grieving over this loss. And what the Buddha is saying is, this is perfectly normal. And the dearer something or someone is to us, the more sorrow and grief is going to arise. It's absolutely natural. And what he's also saying is, there's nothing you can do about this. You can't, because you can't, also you can, go around your whole life avoiding feeling strongly about anything or anyone. Boy, what a horrible life that would be. What a truly horrible life would be to not make those deep connections to different things you do, different people. It would just be void of any great pleasure. Because all the pleasures in life come from those things we love, from people and from activities and whatever, however you want to think about it. We can't live in isolation. We can't avoid this as much as we'd like to. He says, this is another part of, you know, having a life. If you have a life, you're going to have these strong connections to others, and then they'll disappear. Because that's the natural course of things. We can't avoid it. I mean, some people try and avoid it by, you know, and this is actually a very bad reason to become a monastic. To become a monastic is like, oh, now, see, I don't have any family. I've renounced everything. It's just me doing my practice. Terrible reason to become a monastic or to lead a monastic life. I mean, you don't even have to take formal vows. But some people think, well, that's what I'll do. I'll just isolate myself completely from the world and from others, and then I will never have any sorrow. Yeah, I'll also have a really miserable life probably. So it's this tricky area that we have to acknowledge that, of course, things are going to die, whether it's things like our abilities or things like people we love or animals. You know, I can remember one of our cats dying and I was like a wreck. This is my cat, right? But it was like, it was horrible just to be there with that cat at the time. Okay, so that's most of what I want to say from the sutta. There's one other thing I want to come back to eventually. But what did the teaching say about why this is? why is this grief so strong, and why is this grief so hard to deal with? And this is in the Second Noble Truth, the Buddha talks about, you know, basically the cause of unhappiness, of suffering, of feeling things aren't right, arises from our sense that we have a separate self, from clinging to that idea. The reason we suffer when we think about the fact that we're going to die is we cling to the idea that this body is going to exist forever, that it's separate from everything else. This is what Joseph has to say. The fourth of these bonds, and the most subtle, the most deeply conditioned, is our attachment to the belief in self, in I, in me, in mine. The belief that there is some permanent entity in the mind-body which is experiencing all of this. Because of this belief, and to satisfy the I, the self, we get involved in all kinds of unwholesome actions, all kinds of greed and hatred, all kinds of delusion for the gratification of the self, which isn't even there. Our attachment to the concept of self is so great that everything we do revolves about it, tying the bonds even tighter to this mass of pain. Joseph isn't cutting any slack for anybody here. And he's saying that this is the root cause of the suffering we experience. Some, you know, and I'm not saying, once again, well, you know, if we could really figure this out and understand this completely, then we still wouldn't be unhappy when someone passed away. But it would be easier to bear, perhaps. I mean, the Buddha talked about, you know, there'd be great monks that he had trained with, or who he trained, who passed away while he was still alive, and he would talk openly about how sad it was. I mean, he wasn't immune to feeling grief, but he was immune to being so caught up in it that he couldn't function, that he got swept away by it, which is what we have to watch for. Just related to that is another idea. He's talking about craving once again. The second kind of craving the Buddha spoke of goes even deeper than the craving for sense pleasures. It is called the craving for becoming, for renewed existence. This is the very basic urge or desire to be. It is the desire for continuing existence, particularly in pleasant realms. We may or may not believe in rebirth and different planes of existence, although they are mentioned often in the Buddhist teachings. But we don't have to believe in them in order to experience this powerful craving for becoming. We can see it in the planning mind, in the act of imagining ourselves in some future situation. We might be planning for something at work, or perhaps our next vacation. It all starts with just the thought, and then weeks or months or even years later, the whole chain of thoughts and actions has materialized in our lives. Or it hasn't, which is, of course, sometimes the problem. And this is also a problem. We somehow think, this isn't going to happen to me. This is what happens to all those other people. But somehow or other, I'm immune. You know, and our culture certainly encourages us to think that we can be young forever, right? You see ads, be young forever, right? it's so insidious. I think it might be the right word for it, that way of thinking, because it just catches you up in this unreal way of thinking. And interestingly enough, I also think that this practice itself, as you go deeper into this practice, you start to finally, speaking from personal experience here again, start finally to understand that this is the way things are. I had a long retreat. This is 7 or 8 years ago now, where I would have these very intense experiences. I won't call them dreams, because they weren't dreams, because I was sitting, I was awake, but I would be having this experience. I don't know what else to call it, of dying, where I would actually be visualizing myself on my deathbed, dying. And I was always, the interesting thing is, at that point in my practice, I was always like, I was sort of okay. Oh yeah, this is what happens. You know, I was pretty philosophical about it in these events that I was experiencing. But at the same time, my wife was there with me while I was dying, and I was really worried about her. What's she going to do? How's she going to be? So even though I could be, and I could say to her in these visional experiences, it's okay, I'm fine. This is okay, what's happening, I'm perfectly okay with it. I could see that she wasn't, that it was very distressing to her. And so it was distressing to me. And then sometimes these things would switch around, and now she would be dying and I'd be the one who was sitting there with her while she died. And it was exactly the reverse. I would be like freaking out that she was dying and I was going to be left without her. And it's like this went on and on. These things happened for like days. This is my daily experience for several days. And it was like what I was being shown, I think, was that this is what's going to happen. Because you're a human being, because you're connected so strongly to this other person, and sometimes the story would change, and it wouldn't be my wife, it would be one of my kids was dying, or had been murdered. I had one where my daughter was murdered. How that felt, you know, how to deal with that. How to deal with the person who committed the crime. It's like I was living all this at that time to sort of give me an understanding that this is life. This is what's going to happen. You know, the cause of death and dying and aging is birth. I was born. I've had come into relationship with other people who are great, beautiful, loving relationships with my wife and my family, and one really happy about all of that. This is going to happen. And you have to know, you can't pretend that somehow you're exempt from these things. And it doesn't make it easier, I don't think, when I contemplate these things still. But it's like, okay, yeah, that's the truth. I can't deny for one second that that's the absolute truth, that that's part of life, is that all the things I love, as the Buddha will say, dissolve, are going to be gone one day. And I was just being like confronted with this because of my practice, because my mind was so concentrated. I could drop into these mind states where this is what arose so powerfully. One last thing from the sutta, and this is actually from the Satipatthana Sutta, the Buddha's instructions on mindfulness. This is one of the instructions he actually gives on how to develop mindfulness. Again, bhikkhus, as though we were to see a corpse thrown aside in a charnel ground, 1, 2, or 3 days dead, bloated, living, and oozing matter. A bhikkhu compares this same body with it thus. This body too is of the same nature. It will be like that. It is not exempt from that fate. So he's actually recommending that we sit with corpses. In our culture, it's like we just sort of go, ooh, you know. Our culture is all, the whole culture is based around prettying up death, making it look somehow that this person, even though, you know, if you've, you know, I've seen enough embalmed, prettied up corpses in my day, it seems so bizarre to me, you know, that they get, people get, they could actually, you know, there's people whose job it is to dress people up and make them look like they're still alive, even though they're dead. And what the Buddha says, no, no, this is, go look, go see what actually happens. I spent some time in my yoga days going to anatomy labs and actually being there as bodies were being dissected and, you know, watching that process and seeing that happen and understanding how the body works this way. It's a pretty traditional way. But it's like, yeah, this is just, I mean, it looked like a bunch of meat lying on this table. That's what it was. It's all it was. Just lying there and it was being cut open. And it wasn't like, I mean, at one point it was sort of like, this is kind of creepy. And another one is like, oh, this is what happens to bodies. Right there, can't deny it. This is exactly this. Your body's gonna look just like that. Guaranteed. Okay, so I have to take that in. A couple more thoughts here. This is, now we're talking, I wanna talk a little bit about what the Buddha dying, because there's a couple of quite famous teachings revolving around that time when he had actually told his sangha, who would, they'd all gathered together, and, you know, the stories like there were 500 monks and nuns there, 500 renunciates there with him at this time, and he's saying, tomorrow night I'm going. That's it. You know. And he was sort of giving his sangha the last instructions. And they, of course, were like freaking out. You can't go. How can you go? What are we going to do? You're our teacher. Blah, blah, blah. Here's what he said. This is one of the things he said. This is quite a famous quote, actually. Therefore, be ye lamps unto yourselves. Be a refuge to yourselves. Hold fast the truth. Hold fast to truth as a lamp. Hold fast to truth as a refuge. Look not for a refuge in anyone besides yourselves. So first of all, there's this image of a lamp, a light. It's going to light your way. What's going to light your way? Truth. Right here, truth means, in this particular case, the teachings of the Buddha. Hold fast to the truth of these teachings. That's what you need to do. You can't depend on me. I'm going. I'm out of here. You have to depend on yourself. I can't be your refuge. You have to be your own refuge. Be a refuge to yourselves. Look, don't look for refuge in anyone beside yourself. We all, in the end, we're all on our own here. This was the Buddha's last message, pretty much. We're all on our own. We all have to do this for ourselves. No one can do it for us. We have to do our own practice. We have to take care of ourselves. And I'm fascinated. I want to mention a little bit about this image of a light, because it's a lamp or a light occurs in pretty much every spiritual tradition you ever come across. You know, I remember when I was going to Sunday school as a kid, there's this thing about you don't hide your light under a bushel, right? Your light is like that beautiful nature we have. And we don't want to hide it. A bushel was like a big bushel basket. I don't think they must still have bushel baskets, but I never haven't seen one in a long time. But when I was a kid, it was pretty normal to get a bushel of something, and there's a big, huge basket. So it was a strong image for me. Don't hide your light under a bushel. Or, you know, we used to sing this little song, you know, this little light of mine, I'm going to let it shine. So it's like that idea of letting our light shine in the world, because it's for the betterment of the world. Even the words of the, when we talk with the Buddha, we talk about the Buddha being enlightened. Interesting, right? Enlightened. He's becoming lighter, being a greater light. Here's another thought. Like I said, this was just thoughts. And I've seen this in many places. I couldn't find a direct reference to this in my searching for this talk. But I've heard this said many times, that this entire practice is about preparing ourselves for death. What a thought. Huh? This entire practice is preparing us for that time when we're going to be dying. How can we be okay at that moment? Can we still be mindful at that moment? Can we still have this clear mind that stays with what's actually arising? Even if what's arising is on the next breath of the one after, perhaps. That's a pretty powerful thing. I've seen people die that way. Used to do hospice work, and I've seen people who just were ready to go and were just so okay with the whole thing. There's one little hospice story here. This is a man I spent about 6 months visiting him. He had COPD, and he was slowly losing capacity to do things. And I got a call from the hospice that, you know, John wasn't going to live through the day, and if I wanted, it would be good if I could go and be with him one more time before, you know, the family would really like it if I'd go. So I went, got to the house, and his daughter and his granddaughter and the nurse who had been taking care of him for a long time, who I knew quite well, we were all there, and I sat with him too. And I said something like, you know, whenever I used to come and visit John, he always liked to play music and talk about the music he loved. And he was like old time music, right? This wasn't like rock and roll. This was like Frank Sinatra. And so they put on the song, you know, I Did It My Way. And, you know, it's like this beautiful song about this guy who basically says, you know, I went through life and I just did it my way. And at the end of it, usually when Frank Sinatra was singing it, he'd say, and I did it my way, and he'd spread his arms out wide. And we're sitting, listening to the song, and we're not seeing much reaction from John. And then right at the end of the song, he lifts his arms up like this. I did it my way. He was like, this is what I'm doing this my way. He died 20 minutes later, just like that. He was ready to go, and he went. perfectly all right. He did it his way. Even how he died, he did it his way. It was a beautiful thing to see. You know, it's anyhow, that's, he was prepared. He was really prepared to go. And he just went with the little song in his heart, so to speak. Couple of the things I want to read. Where's, I have to find the right book. Ah, here it is. Here is this book. This is Joseph talking. This is a section. It's called Death and Loving Kindness. You don't really think of those two things together, right? Death and loving kindness. And he very sort of, I think, quite brilliantly in this little section, connects those two quite deeply. An image often used to describe the practice of insight is that of walking a tightrope. As we're walking the tightrope, it becomes clear that the one thing we must pay attention to is balance, maintaining perfect poise. Walking while on the tightrope, different things come whizzing by us. Different sights and sounds, emotions, ideas, and realizations. If they are pleasant, the conditioned tendency of mind is to reach out, trying to hold on to them, trying to make them stay. If the sights and sounds are unpleasant, the tendency of mind is to reach out in aversion, trying to push them away. In both cases, we reach out, and in the reaching, lose our balance and fall. Both positive and negative reactions are equally dangerous. Anything at all, however glorious or terrifying, which causes us to lose the perfect balance of the mind, makes us fall. So we work again and again to develop a mind which doesn't react with clinging or condemning, attachment or aversion to any of these objects. Developing a mind which clings to nothing, to absolutely nothing whatever, just allowing it all to come and pass away. Non-attachment grows out of the deep insight into impermanence. One level of this insight is recognizing the inevitability and imminence of our death. In the Bhagavad Gita, the question is asked, of all the wonders, which is the most wonderful? The answer, that no man, though he sees others dying all around him, believes that he himself will die. Each of us has deeply ingrained patterns which bear witness to everything we do. Often these are destructive habits like anger or self-pity. But in just the same way, we can learn to keep in mind the awareness of death and have it bear witness to all our actions. If we take death as our advisor, we live each moment with the power and fullness we would give to our last endeavor on earth. When we keep death at our fingertips, we become less involved, less compulsive about the satisfaction or gratification of various desires in the moment. When not so clouded by desires and fantasies, we're less inclined to hold onto things and more open to love and generosity. The awareness of death provides a space of clarity in which we can understand the process of who it is that we are, and who it is that dies. Insight into impermanence on this level is the awareness of transitory temporal nature of all phenomena from moment to moment. In every moment, the mind-body process, our entire universe is arising and passing away, dying and being reborn. He's literally saying every second we're dying and being reborn again, every breath. We die, and then we're reborn again. We work on developing a mind that is silent and still, one that is unmoving in the face of such enormous change. The whole practice evolves organically from simply being aware of what's happening in the present moment without reacting. One meditation teacher in India has said that all you have to do is sit and know that you are sitting, and the whole of the Dharma will be revealed. You'll clearly see the unfolding of the laws of nature, and then the Dharma truly becomes your own. During this organic evolution, born of balance and detachment, many beautiful and freeing qualities of mind begin to manifest. One of these qualities is metta, love for oneself in the sense of being allowing and non-judging, having a spaciousness and a lightness in the mind, and a strong loving kindness towards others, not relating in terms of grasping or need or attachment. So awareness and acceptance of death leads to loving kindness. What an interesting idea. It's hard to grasp how those two fit together so clearly. But Joseph makes it quite clear here. There's one more thing about the Buddha. The last words of the Buddha. This is, once again, quite traditional. The very last words he said before he stopped speaking, and then he died soon thereafter. Indeed, bhikkhus, I declare this to you. This is his last lesson. It is the nature of all formations to dissolve. It's talking about his own body dissolving, right? It is the nature of all formations to dissolve. Attain perfection through diligence. And then he stopped talking. Indeed, because I declare this to you, it is the nature of all formations to dissolve. Attain perfection through diligence. So be aware that all formations, including this one and all those other things that we love, all those formations are dissolving right in front of us every day, as much as we don't want to think about it. So I want to read a Mary Oliver poem here to finish off. This is a collection of poems called Thirst. These were all written fairly soon after her partner of many years had passed away. It's called Heavy. Description of how we often feel at that time. That time I thought I could not go any closer to grief without dying. I went closer and I did not die. Surely God had his hand in this, as well as friends. Still, I was bent, and my laughter, as the poet said, was nowhere to be found. Then my friend Daniel, brave even among lions, is not the weight you carry, but how you carry it. Books, bricks, grief, it's all in the way. You embrace it, balance it, carry it, when you cannot and would not put it down. So I went practicing. Have you noticed? Have you heard the laughter that comes now and again out of my startled mouth? How I linger to admire the things of this world that are kind and maybe also troubled. Roses in the wind, the sea geese on the steep waves, a love to which there is no reply. So Mary Oliver understood. May the beneficial energies arising from our practice here together today become the causes and conditions for the end of suffering and the awakening of all beings everywhere. Thank you for joining me. You can turn your mics on now. I turned the recording off. Okay, so I'll see you all again. Once again, I have no idea what I'm going to talk about next week. I'm just taking this week by week, and then you'll get something in your email in a few days that'll tell you what the latest topic's going to be.
Sounds good. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you.
Nice to see you.
Nice to see you. Everybody have a good night.
You too.
Thank you.
Okay.